Globally, an estimated 35% of women experience some form of sexual violence in their lifetime. In Africa, that percentage increases to 45%. According to the UN Population Fund, almost 50% of all sexual assault victims are girls age 15 or younger. In the slums of Nairobi, where a program called No Means No started, one in four girls are raped every year. Stay with me and be filled with hope because of a global rape prevention program whose mission is to end sexual violence against women and children and to dropping those numbers significantly. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. It's an important one to be a part of now more than ever. Before we get on with the show, a heartfelt and sincere thanks to an avid Mrs. Green's World supporter and Patreon member who cares deeply about this issue, so much so that she sponsored this show. She wishes to remain anonymous, which is so her, and of course we sincerely appreciate it and her for all of her support. So now please join me in welcoming our guest for this next hour to talk with us about stopping rape culture and empowering youth now. With me is Lee Paiva. She is the founder of No Means No Worldwide. Lee, I think you can tell how excited I am to have you and how passionate I am about this issue. So thanks to saying yes for being here.
Aww. An honor. I'm happy to be here, and I'm excited too.
Well, for people like you that do something like this that is so driven by their passion, an opportunity to talk about it on national radio is a great excitement because you're of your passion. You want to tell your story. So I want to understand what made you start the work. You were in Nairobi, from what I have researched. You were with your husband. It was back in 2006. You were an artist from San Francisco working in a Nairobi slum. There's kind of like pieces you have to fill in for us. You were checking on a microloan program. And then your translator began to tell you stories about people on the street. What was she telling you, and what kind of impact was it having on you at that time?
Well, we were walking down a road in Korogocho slum in Nairobi, and you got to picture this. There's no, you know, pavement. It's open sewers on the sides of the road, and the houses and the businesses are shacks, corrugated metal. It's a pretty intense place, and I was just coming in there from the rural areas doing support for AIDS orphans. And we were looking to bring some of that programming into the slums in Nairobi. So we were walking along. We were visiting some of the microloan businesses that my husband and some investors had started. And I had this woman. She was translating for me as we walked along the road. And she was in hushed tones. She was saying to me, "Do you see that girl over there? She was raped by her father. And she's HIV positive now. Oh, do you see that woman that just walked out? She has a... her baby was raped." And then we'd walk a little further and she'd say, "Oh, did you see that woman just come out? She was raped, and that baby is a rape baby." And then, I mean, it's just like this nightmare world. And finally she said, "This is the place where they put the body of a grandmother. She had been raped to death, and this is where they left her." And now, doing AIDS orphan care and support, what you find really quickly in Africa is that, you know, at that time there were just millions of AIDS orphans because the parent age men and women were dying out. They were the hardest hit. So what's left behind are these young children and these grandmothers. And so the grandmothers are just taking in all these orphans. And at the time, especially, it just seemed like they were carrying the AIDS orphan crisis on their back. Like, that was their burden. It had fallen to them. And so I had gotten really close to the grandmother community, some women taking in 11 orphans. I mean, it was just astonishing, the poorest minority in the communities were these grandmothers. So when I heard about the grandmother, it was just like this little snap moment where I just realized, oh, so you work all your life, you have children, you think they'll come back and help you out. And instead they come home, they leave their children and they die, and you've worked hard all your life, and at the end of your life you're living in a shack in Nairobi, and then your death is that you're raped and murdered. And I just thought that was like, I just knew, and I'll talk a lot about these moments where I just knew I wasn't going to be able to go back to my life in California and San Francisco the way that it was. Like, that life just, it just seemed over. Like, I knew I was going to do something about this. And I wasn't quite sure what yet, but I knew. I just took this breath, and it was, everything changed in that moment.
So, you know, needless to say, I have chills going up and down my spine about just getting my head around the research when I was preparing to say the words on the air that 1 in 4 girls are raped every year. Like, we don't have a sense for that. And there's enough sexual violence in the United States. I don't want to minimize it, but those numbers are astounding. So you were touched beyond measure. It, like an arrow got shot into your heart, clearly. At what point did you decide what to do about it? And how did you start it? I mean, it's like, here you are, a white woman in Nairobi from San Francisco, or, you know, the West Coast. And what happened? What's happened next?
The story I want to tell about that is rather personal, in that I come from a very intense childhood.
Okay.
I've experienced a lot of the things that a lot of the women and children in the slums experience. I didn't grow up in a slum, and I didn't grow up in the project, but I was pretty poor. Dual addicted parents, mental illness, severe neglect. I had a lot of the stuff going on. I didn't really realize that it would ever serve a purpose.
But it was literally trauma, relatable.
Right?
I mean, that makes it so intense. Seriously. It was relatable.
Well, I think what happened was I became a very aggressive teenager, a very, very aggressive teenager. And I was angry, and I just had a lot of problems. And in order to continue being an aggressive teenager, I didn't go into my first empowerment self-defense class so that I could learn to protect myself. I just wanted to fight better. I was getting into all kinds of fights, right? So, so that's kind of like where the journey began for me. So I thought, when I went into that class, so many things in my life changed. And part of it was just like when you grow up with neglect and abuse, you kind of think that, the most powerful people are the ones that are the meanest. They're the loudest. They're the toughest. They'll go to the, they'll go to the mat. They'll go to the nth degree to win. And that's kind of the only power that I had ever seen. So when I went into my empowerment self-defense class, I learned a whole new kind of power. And I just never knew that kind of perspective or attitude existed. It was a real shift for me. And so I began to think that those strategies that I learned would be life-saving in the environment that I had just left.
Right.
And I ended up contacting my own teachers in San Francisco, to see if they would come and maybe teach some classes there. And through that, we started the first year-round full-time empowerment self-defense team in a slum in the world. Immediately, I began to see the possibilities, but also that it was going to need to grow to begin to even meet the demand and the need, I should say, at that time. The need was enormous, and we were seeing what kind of effect we could have. So it kind of grew out of that.
A very, very personal place with a strong sense of purpose. And thank you for feeling as though you were able to share that with us. I really appreciate that a lot. And I'm not sure we have to talk much more about the scope of the problem and how pervasive it is, because I did some of that in my intro. But is there anything, like you describe, when I was listening to you, it's a rape culture. It's if a woman, a grandmother, like I'm sitting here thinking, it's rare in the United States that a grandmother gets raped to death. I mean, it makes national news. So it's a culture of people living with that as a norm. Is that fair to say? it's like, oh yeah, well, this happens, and this woman's pointing it out. Oh yeah, that one and that one, and that's a baby, a rape baby, and all that. Is it still something perceived to be heinous and awful, or is there a certain like numbness about this is our reality?
Well, right now, I'm not so sure that you could say that some of the reasoning that was in place at the time, which was these grannies are age-free based on the fact that they're still alive and they can heal me, they can cure me. That was a belief that was happening. They were also seen as really vulnerable and easy prey. So these were really intense attacks. They would, you know, they were gang attacks, and they would go in and take everything, and then they would stay in there for like 6 to 11 hours sometimes. There were a lot of granny bodies dumped in the river, and it's near the area where this was all happening, which is an area called Grogan B. I'm not so sure that those beliefs are still in play in that area, because I want to point out that while we say that we get rate down by 50% wherever we go, the area of Golden Bee, where the grandmothers are, is the only place on the planet where rate has gone down to zero. So in the past 3 years, it's been verified that not a single granny that's taken our classes, and these grannies have advanced training. They're probably, they've been training every weekend since I was there in 2007. They've never stopped. And so they are kind of like masters of this at this point.
Wow.
They've been able to achieve something that I don't know that anyone else has been able to achieve. So there's a crew of them, and there's a lot of films online about these grannies. There's just dozens. People go in and they tell the story. There's a really beautiful one out right now, but check it out. You know, the Kenyan grannies, they've been training since 2007, so they're in their 11th year. They've had advanced training, multiple attackers, weapons. So it's a pretty intense story. You know, that's the goal, right? It's like, if I ever think, oh, it's pie in the sky to think we can end this, I just look towards the grannies and I go, yeah, the weakest, the oldest, the poorest, the frailest are the first. You know, the first shall be the last and the last shall be the first.
Yes,
well,
yes.
They got it down to zero. And if you walk through Grogan B, it is one of the most intense places that I've ever been. I mean, it's so dense in there. The energy is just, it's unbelievable. It's almost like a dead zone in the water.
Yeah. You can't even get your head around it sitting here in the comfort of my studio. Tell us about the program. I'd like to know some of the, literally, what do? You. I love that you don't just train girls. I think it's really important. But what do you actually do in the program? What do they learn? Eye gouges? They get, you know, kick an eye in the crotch? What is the program makeup? What do you do?
We start out with voice assertiveness. We go into personal rights and awareness of your rights to take care of yourself and do what you need to do to stay safe. We do skills training, right? So it's not a lecture. You know, at least 6 hours of skills training. So they're empowerment skills, how to say no effectively. We call it like a high-level no, a believable no.
Right.
Self-esteem development, efficacy. And then we teach physical defense, just in case your no is not respected. You know, what do you do then? And so we teach physical skills as a last resort, as a last or best resort. So we do a lot of verbal training before we really get into the physical stuff.
Okay.
So these skills are, for girls, they work across her lifetime. You know, once she has them, they're hers for life, and she can use them with a boyfriend, a teacher, an employer, a conflict, a stranger. You know, they have a wide variety of uses. They'll be using them over and over in life, just as I have since I got them. You know, so that's for the girls. Do you want me to talk about the boys?
Sure, but before we go into that, I definitely want you to talk about the boys. What about there's cultural differences. How did you get them engaged? Was there resistance? you know, women are raised so differently in many cultures. How did you permeate the culture so that this was not only accepted, but embraced? How did you cross those cultural norms and maybe barriers? Who did you get to help you with those pieces? Or were you just a miracle magic worker, which you are?
I think that by hiring people, young people from these communities, that was really, really important. People that were young enough for the kids to relate to seemed to be important to them.
Yes.
There's an understanding that violence, particularly sexual violence, it doesn't really change too much as people might think. The same ploys are generally used around the world. You know, getting someone alone, getting someone drunk, grabbing them, ganging up on them, you know, testing them, asking them what time it is and getting close to them and seeing, you know, these are just like, they're everywhere. And it's across the board, a lot of the ploys that I use to attack someone are remarkably similar around the world. So knowing what those are and getting really specific ones from the community, from the kids themselves, like you don't bring in like, oh, and then he came by in his car and he tried to pull me in it. That doesn't really happen too much in the slums. Not a lot of people have cars. So you're listening to them and you're getting, you know, these pre-clash, you're getting scenarios of what's really common types of attacks, and you're using those to, in your role plays, in the 6 hours of skills building, right? You're just using what they tell you is happening. You know, for example, for physical, they said there were, a lot of people put them in headlocks, right? That's how they grabbed them. And so they put them in, so they wanted to make sure that we covered headlocks. And that's just giving you an example of just like being able to titrate a curriculum towards the actual scenarios. But a lot of this stuff just crosses all boundaries and borders because of the similarities of the tactics used since time immemorial, right, of these guys. So the other powerful thing is bypass everybody you can and get right to the woman, get right to the child. You know, just go right to them directly with the skills and create some kind of foundation for those skills to rest on, and then begin the work of building up those skills. And a lot of things happen around self-esteem when you have dozens and dozens of skills in places where you just didn't know what to do when somebody put their hand on your thigh, you know, right, or somebody right. You felt somebody's hand on your, you know, you place all that with dozens of strategies of, you know, what is the situation? What are the clues that are coming in this situation telling me? And what is my response? Because I've got dozens to choose from now. So it has a remarkable effect on the person.
And you make such a good point, because in doing my research, what just absolutely blew me away is that your comment about this knows no borders, because every 2 minutes, an American is sexually assaulted in this country. And the big shocker to me, which I thought I knew and I wanted to research it, is 3 out of 4 rapes are committed by someone known to the victim, at least in the United States. It's not strangers. So there's all of that you talked about setting the scene. It's not a lot of, you know, like stopping someone in the car and saying, oh, come on over here. You're absolutely right. It's a real victim predator mindset, and it certainly knows no boundaries. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. And believe it or not, we're going to have to take a break. And I want to not forget, I definitely don't want to forget about talking about the boys, because I particularly loved the approach you take. In some sense, and I have to be careful saying this, and if you want to react, it's okay. The boys are victims too. They don't grow up wanting to rape their sister or a grandmother or whatever. It's a learned behavior from what I have been able to observe and research. So when we come back, can we talk a little bit about the boys? There's so many more things I want to talk about, and including your definition of the word empowerment, because it's thrown around a lot, but you have very clear very clear ideas about what that means to get a girl or a woman to empower themselves. You can't empower anyone. They get to learn skills to empower them. So everybody, stay here with me. So much more to learn about this really important program, changing the landscape of our planet. We'll be right back.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and SpeakUp Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. Stopping the rape culture and empowering youth now, is it possible? Can just one organization make an impact? The answer, as we are learning, is a resounding yes. With us this hour is Lee Paiva. She is the founder of No Means No Worldwide. The program was featured in the New York Times as a global rape prevention program and described as a worldwide teaching program to stop rape. The program and its results have been and continue to be extremely effective, and we're going to talk about that. So, Lee, thank you so much, not only for being here, but for your willingness to share your story, your journey, and the impact that you're having on thousands of lives throughout the world. So let's talk about boys. What are you doing with boys, and why is that important?
This is such an important question and such an important issue. I think when I first started working with boys, the question was normally, you know, are you teaching them not to rape? And the thing that I'm learning about boys is that, in a sense, they're just as trapped as the girls. So if we imagine, you know, growing up and being told you can never cry, you can never feel, and if you have any feelings, you can't show them, you have to always be in control. You have to be tough. Don't ever show anything remotely feminine about yourself. Don't journal. So many humane elements are... boys are taught to fight against, to simply erase from themselves. And that is stifling. It's absolutely stifling. And to grow up in a culture where, you know, that like I did, I guess, to say, like, just where the meanest, the loudest, the toughest, the roughest, the most violent person wins, is to be in the world of boys. And what we found out was that boys where we work spend their day with one main mission. How do I not get beaten?
Ugh.
How do I not get beaten is my main thing, by cops, by brothers, by bullies, by parents, by priests, by everybody kind of has license to hit boys because they're high energy and there could be this trouble or dishonest or, you know, so I have found them to be just as trapped in a lot of ways in their socialization as the girls. And so as we think about them as the privileged class, what is privilege when you can't feel, when you can't cry, when you can't love, when you just rather be feared than loved? So our work with boys is really our work with boys. In middle school age, we do not try to make them instruments of safety for girls. I think if we did, they'd smell a rat. Like, aren't you here for me?
Yes.
Yeah, so we really go in and try to be focused on those boys themselves. What's going on with you? So we do a lot of stuff on resilience and empathy, positive self-talk. We even do meditation with them. We do personal safety strategies around awareness and how did they get through their tween years, I'll say, without adopting the oppressive, violent culture around them. because there's a part of boys' lives where they don't want to kiss girls, right?
Right.
And the next time you have anything to do with girls is when they're in that relationship age. And there's already this negative gender stereotyping where there's a sense of ownership around girls. Once they start wanting to go on dates, girls are definitely in some cultures supposed to do what you tell them to do.
Right, right.
And, yeah, so I think that if you come in, if we can create empathy in boys for themselves, for their own situation and their own trauma-driven behavior, then when they get to that point with girls, they're more likely to be friends with them and have empathy for them and see the girls' trauma-driven behavior instead of adopting this oppressive attitude. Because research shows boys in the middle school age, they didn't adopt those negative gender stereotypes, but when we got to high school, they were entrenched. So what's going on between middle school and high school for boys? And that's what we wanted to look at. So you can see how far away we went from teach boys not to rape. It's so much more intense than doing something like that. It would be easy to go in and lecture them, but that's definitely not going to create the world that we're trying to create.
And you are taking such a, what I call an integrated approach, and approaching them with respect and the opportunity to value themselves. I mean, that's a totally different way than saying, you know, you do this and you do that and you're bad and stop doing it to girls. I mean, it's one of the most exciting aspects to your program from where I sit. And obviously, I'm not alone because it's working. So in your journey, I'm sure you could, I haven't cried much on the air in 11 years and I'm an easy crier, but without any ado and no holds barred, do you, Lee, have a story about a girl or a boy and seeing a transformation in their lives at the top of your head that you'd like to share? Because our listeners and I love to hear stories about one person, one boy, one girl. Do you have any, does anything pop up?
Yeah. I think Anna's story is profound. So Anna lives in a slum in Nairobi, and she lived in one of those corrugated shacks, and a gang of men, I think it was five men, came in and they robbed the place. And it was Anna, her mother, and her sister. And when they left, they took Anna with them. And they brought her down to one of these just empty corrugated shacks that are just so disgusting, I can't even describe them. And they told her to lie down. And so Anna is 11 at the time. And she looked at the guys and she said to herself, I know that one of these men has AIDS. I'm not going to go that way, the slow way. I might as well just die now. So she said, you'll have to kill me. So the five guys said, they just looked at each other. One of them pulled out his knife, his machete, and he hit her on the head with it. And she said, oh, I didn't die. I guess this is the time to use my self-defense. Those skills those girls taught me. So she got into her stance and she kicked the leader in front of her in the groin, and he fell down. And then she elbowed the person holding her really hard in the ribs, and he fell down. And she just turned around and ran, and she said that they just stood there. They were so stunned. Looking at the guys on the ground.
Oh, my God.
So she ran away, and then she said, I'm closer to the hospital than home. So she ran, and she ran, and she got herself some help. And so Anna's story, what changed is that she lived. She didn't get AIDS. You know?
Yes.
She used her skills, and she used them really judiciously. And that's the story, I think, that people can't accept about young children sometimes, is that they could have that kind of wherewithal and that kind of calm in a situation like that to kind of make those kinds of decisions and get away. But I've seen hundreds. We have over 1,000 film testimonials of kids telling unbelievable stories like that. And I think we vastly underestimate the power in these kids.
And she was 11. Like, I want to just ring the bell and say, people, do you hear this? She was 11. I was barely stopping playing with dolls when I was 11, and I'm so not kidding. Of course, that was in the dark ages, but we don't need to go there. But it's like, to think about this in the context of my world is mind-boggling. So what about a boy story? That was just, you know, I want to press pause and everybody let that sink in about the power and the impact. You don't need to describe empowering now, because that's clearly giving girls the skill set to be able to make that decision and have the presence of mind. So what about, do you have the Anna equivalent of a boy story?
Yeah, I mean, I like the story of James. This is a boy again in Nairobi, and he saw a man pulling a little girl along the riverbank, and he stopped and he watched, and he saw the man trying to take off the kid's diaper, and he just, you know, knew this guy's going to rape this kid, so he decides that he can't do the intervention alone, which is one of the skills, right? He goes and gets some other guys, and he gets them to help him confront the man and get the little girl away from him, which they did. And I just think that there's about six skills in there that they used. But I think that we have to remember what happens when, you know, they rescue this kid. They'll tell a bunch of kids about what they did. You know, they'll tell their story. It'll inspire other kids to do the same, to stop, you know, to get help when you can't do it alone.
Yes, yes.
It's a really powerful example of what we do. It's a microcosm of what we're trying to do, which is to bring out the skills that allow someone, like, boys are really into heroism. You know what I mean? And if we can kind of key into that in a way that's safe for them, then they begin to be able to act within their community to build the community that they want, because they have the skills to do it. And if it's not safe for them, they can actually go and get help and get numbers. And those boys will be telling that story and be proud of themselves for the rest of their lives. And that little girl was saved, because the chances are, I've been there, you would have just thrown that kid in the river. And this is, you know, no exaggeration. I know that river, I know that area, and it's highly likely that would have been what happened. And
powerful, yeah, doesn't that's quite, it doesn't even, like, I can't find any words. That's beyond powerful and important, and it's changing. I think about the ripple effect. You're talking about a systemic change for a culture, an entire culture, is what is so illustrative in that story. What about, I just have to go back for a minute, change directions for a minute. You know, you shared what happened to you personally, growing up tough, it was rough, but there's a whole nother piece of you that's in this story that I'd like to ask you about, because that's part of your background, but what else prepared you? What No Means No Worldwide is doing is changing the face of the planet. And that's not an exaggeration, because you're not just changing one life. So it's really impactful. But what did you have that you took on doing these things in a country that was not your own? It's not like you went to France. You went to Nairobi. And different culture, different challenges, different beliefs. What skill sets did you have? And this is for our listeners. Like, you know, people think it's amazing that I started Mrs. Green's World when I had a background in social services. Well, it pales in comparison to you did something far, far away. What do you think was in you that made you up to it?
I just had no idea that I just started small. I started with something that I thought was doable. I'm just going to get the skills that I got from this place here.
Got it.
And I'm going to move them over to here. I mean, it was that simple. I had no idea. I didn't see it that way. You know, I just thought these skills that are undervalued here in the States would be life-saving here. And
right.
It's a simple matter of just getting them over there.
Right, right.
And that was where it started. And then it's almost like in life, maybe doing something like this is a bit like following the breadcrumbs to the next thing and going,
yes.
Oh,
yes.
I see, more is needed here. Oh, I see, we need to do something with boys. Oh, I see. You know, it's just one, it just grows, you know, out of itself.
So, yeah, I mean, with a lot of help. So it's like, yeah, there's no playing small on Mrs. Green's World. But I understand you started with trying to make a difference for this community and those girls in it. So that's the important takeaway for me. And then what about, because you were operating in a different culture, in a different part of the world, you're white and the beat goes on, what did you have a lot of resistance? Like in Afghanistan, there are programs that they're banished now. The women are not allowed in villages, in some villages. Did you have resistance from the culture or the people that you were trying to impact?
There were little pockets and experiences of resistance. There might be a teacher that doesn't want this in their school. There might be a community that doesn't like it, that their kid didn't get hired, but somebody else's kid did. I mean, there are just weird little things like that. But for the most part, it was started in such a small local way, and it just kind of expanded outward. So, you know, it's like, it wasn't like a wall of resistance, a community of resistance,
right.
An organization of resistance. It was just these little experiences of resistance. That's all that I really remember of that. You know, there was no organized resistance that I could see. And right now, you know, we get papers in Kenya from the government. I have to mention here that the organization that I work with in Kenya is called Ujamaa Africa. They're in the trenches every day. I'm not. I've been working with them for years. I started No Means No Kenya there. But I just want to give a shout out to them because they've been doing this for years and doing a lot of the implementation. And they're a really great partner. So I just wanted to let people know that we work through partners in country, right? So we're working through Ujamaa, and they are the ones that, you know, those are the teachers that I trained, and they go out there every day, and they're training in schools every day, and they're expanding into Malawi or going into Somalia, you know, so they're doing really, really important work, and I just wanted to give them a shout out.
It's wonderful that you did that. Yeah. No, that's really important. It is. Nobody does this by themselves. And if they do think that they do, they're delusional. So I'm not at all surprised that you wanted to do that, given your mission. It's so in character for a person that's doing what you're doing. So thank you for that. Let's switch a little bit now to something that I feel is so significant and so important. And if we run up against the second break, we'll come back to it. But I come from a health and human service background working with at-risk children and families. And to me, something stellar and outstanding about your program is your investment in academic peer-reviewed research on programming for almost 10 years, since 2009. And I think it's just, I mean, right on the website, you have 4 published papers in major scientific journals in collaboration with Stanford University and Johns Hopkins University, some of the top universities in our country. And one of your random control trials has been accepted by Prevention Science for publication. It's probably out in 2017, and now 2 are in process. This is where I want to ask you about skill set. Why is that so important? And we'll never finish in the 2 minutes we have before the break, but we can go back to it. So why, to me, that sets you apart from so many other programs. It's proven.
Ah, well, I started a program in 2007. It was the forerunner to No Means No Worldwide. And at one point, I was just starting to get out there and ask people for money for financial help. And I remember saying, yeah, we taught 60,000 kids last year. And this little voice said, how do you know what they got?
Wow.
How do you know that what you taught reach that 12-year-old girl who's going to be raped by her neighbor this Friday when her mom leaves for work? How do you know that you reached her? And at that moment,
oh,
I said,
gosh,
I'm not going to ask anybody for another dime until I can definitively answer that question. And that's what I did. From that moment on, everything had to be researched. And now I'm like a huge research snob because I need to know what's working.
Yes.
You know, it's like you need to know what's working. And how else can you, I mean, I've seen so many fronts for dysfunctional organizations now that it's really is a crime, but you know, it's a crime. And so I want to make sure that what we're doing is going exactly where it's going, which is direct action with women and for women and children.
And you got it, kiddo. It was like, yeah, you got it. And it costs money and it takes time. Everybody, we'll be right back. If you're feeling what I'm feeling, you won't want to miss a word. Lee Paiva, we'll be right back.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
And welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We thank you for being a part of our world and for joining us to hear about such an important topic that is part of our social justice leg of Mrs. Green's World. We cannot have a sustainable planet without having a socially just one, and that is why Lee is our guest today. Her name is Lee Paiva. She is the founder of No Means No Worldwide, and we're talking about stopping rape culture and empowering youth now, which is just what they're doing. So Lee, sometimes I get so caught up in our guest answers that I forget to ask some very important questions. Let's talk about your results. There's research that I wanted to set the stage is peer-reviewed, and I wish everybody who's listening would go to the website, nomeansnoworldwide.org, because it's a beautiful journey with beautiful faces and beautiful stories and impactful information. So talk us through some of the impact, the decreases in rape, and so forth.
So the key findings after our classes are that the girls who used Empower Skills to stop the rapists in the year after the training did a 50% drop in sexual assault.
Jeez.
So some of these girls are using these more than once, right? So 50% drop in rape by the girl side of the program. There was a 42 to 60% decrease in the overall incidence of rape. So we're talking about a spectrum of results there. So all the way up to 60%. Of the boys who witnessed physical or sexually assaultive behavior in the year following our high school age boys class, 74% successfully intervened to stop it. And then there's a decrease in teen pregnancy-related school dropouts by 46%. There is a really interesting study now, we call it a gap study, where we learned that the schools we went to 4 years ago, when we go back, the rate of rape has not gone back up again in 4 years. So that's probably
important.
One of the most fascinating things.
Oh, yes.
That's just crazy.
That's
just crazy.
It is just crazy. It's like crazy.
But that's just what we found. It's not published. It's just something that we're looking at right now that I think is really intense. It's profoundly important.
But when I talk about systemic change, that's what I mean. It's not just a one-off where here's this great 12-hour skill-based program and Hakuna Matata, hope you learned a lot. When you go into what you're going into, it changes behavior and it has a ripple effect and it'll change it for generations. I mean, you're stopping the act of violence for thousands. So it's sustainable. which I think is also beyond impressive. Do you have a sense for, I'm very curious about this, what sets your program apart? I mean, there are lots of rape prevention programs, and I am biased. Maybe I haven't studied enough of them, but I did a lot of reading and what I call going down the rabbit hole till very late in the night about your program. And because of my background in social services, it's like it's beyond what I say, beyond Thunderdome impressive. What do you think sets it apart? What is different about yours, or is there anything different?
Oh, yeah. It's actually the women's movement of the 70s. They were a group of women who wanted to break through the male martial arts, you know, glass ceiling. They wanted to learn martial arts, and at that time, it was a thoroughly male game. So they started, learning martial arts, and out of that grew these self-defense strategies for women. By women for women. And so we're talking about over 40 years here. And these women are the pioneers of what we teach girls. And I wish I could take credit and be all brilliant, but that's what's going on. There's no other prevention thing out there that has a 40-year test run, right? So if you take a class and somebody introduces a move, and the move against the assailant causes the woman or the defender to fall backwards onto a wrist with the possibility of injury, it's out.
Right.
You don't see that again.
Right.
So all these strategies are like tested and put in. They're brilliant. It's a masterwork. It really, really is. So all I did was titrate it for extreme risk environments. And, it's almost like if you have 12 hours in the life of a child and you are in an extreme risk environment, you have to strip the whole thing down to what's essential. What's essential and what are the stories that they're telling you that they need, and then you build it around that. And so that, I feel like that's my participation. A lot of, money and time and resources, but essentially I'm using an intervention that is pretty much a masterwork. Not so with the boys. The boys' programming of what works to prevent violence in boys is in its infancy. And we're really working hard to try to get funding and resources to develop a research base on that. Because there's a tendency with boys to roll out a program, and then when you don't see the results that you want, it's gone.
Right.
You don't learn about it. And I wish that we did, because we could learn so much from what isn't working, right? So there's very few organizations, I think UNH has bringing in the bystander, that have statistically significant results with boys. And one thing to say about this is that what we know, what we've learned, is there's no plug and play on violence prevention. It's a comprehensive approach, or you're not going to get anything at all. It's just not that kind of like surfacey thing that you can just sweep in and deal with. This is a really deep, deep dive, because you can have all the awareness campaigns in the world and you'll have the majority of guys, they don't see themselves as a rapist. They don't see this as anything addressing them, because their picture of a rapist doesn't match what they do, right? So we have all of this programming around this, and I don't think people can comprehend how difficult it is to to pierce the denial around how men think about women and the way that they treat them. I know you told me a story off the air that we were just marveling at the absolute craziness of some of this stuff. And we just go, oh, that, that's crazy. Those guys do that. Well, it's kind of coming from somewhere. And it's with a major level of denial. I mean, I'd love to talk about Louis C.K. and what happened with him. One of the most brilliant, insightful guys out there. And yet, he's doing what he's doing. And then when he gets caught, he says, sorry, and then everyone jumps on him and says, that sorry's not real. It's like, no, his sorry won't be real for a long time until he deeply, deeply, deeply understands what he did.
Yeah.
He it takes a long time for men to get down to this level, and a lot of times I found that men don't want to see themselves in as anything to do with this. And this is, to us, it's the us problem, not a girl's problem, not a boy's problem. This is an us problem. But yeah, the levels of denial, and my thing with Louis is I want him to get help and come back and be an ally. I'm not really in the punishing anger mode anymore. I'm really trying to figure out what works for these guys. And I'd love to know, if anybody knows, what is Louis C.K. getting now for help?
Yeah.
What's out there? I have no idea what's out there. I mean, we've had sexual harassment posters in buildings and office places for 20, 25 years now, and here we are.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is going to work is not, it's not what we think. It's a complex, comprehensive plan, and that's what's going to work in the end. And I one last thing I have to say this is we do not believe that we are the end all be all. We are one component of what I think is four or five key inputs that will end violence as we know it. So I definitely don't want people thinking that we think that, because we certainly don't. There's an education component. There's an employment component. There's a trauma component. These need to be in place for us to really see the change that we want to see around violence prevention.
And that's a wonderful thing to share, because there can't be enough of programs like this. I mean, from what I could read, you have already impacted the lives of 300,000 boys and girls in Kenya and Malawi, and your work continues. But it's not like you want an exclusive. The more programs that are impactful and changing it is better. I think it's really interesting to think about what you said, to take a deeper dive about what you said, because I'm listening and I'm thinking what you're really saying is they don't think what they're doing is rape. And I mean, I've used that to describe certain people in our country that say they don't think that rape is a thing, because they can do whatever they want with women. So that's kind of, you know, a scary thought. You have to let them know that it is a violent crime before they're going to own behavior. And to them, it wasn't. It's a really scary thought as a woman to have that.
It's just kind of normal to think I'm going to get her drunk. That's, everybody does it. That's normal. I'm going to target her. I'm going to get her drunk. And then she, you know, she'll complain about it in the morning. I mean, there's so many ways in which this is normal behavior, and yet 10 questions in, he might begin to see a way in which he does fit a description somewhere. But because the description isn't his description,
then, you know
what I mean? It's like the denial there is just, it's unbelievable. That's all I can say about it. It's just, one time we had a class with our, we were training the male instructors in our class. And so we had a week-long training, and then I said, to strengthen some of the intervention skills, de-escalation, negotiation, I said, could you please take the first 3 days of the women's training, which is all verbal, and that way you guys will strengthen your intervention skills and your ability to teach them. And what ended up happening was they take the 3 days with the women, and they walk out of those classes, and they're just like, oh, my God. We had no idea how afraid of us you are. We had no idea how much you think about us walking towards you. We had no idea how many strategies you use to stay safe from us. We had no idea what, you know, all the time that you put in protecting yourself. They just have no concept of it, you know? So you know, all week long we're training them in these strategies and all of this, but what really opened their eyes was putting them in the position of women to say, oh my God, you're terrified of us. They
powerful. Oh my gosh. Like, so powerful and transformative. I mean, I get it. So vis-a-vis the Me Too movement here, which has really helped women in our country raise awareness, has it impacted your work? Has it helped at all? And if so, how so? Or were your thoughts were, yeah, we've been doing this. I'm sure you think it's great that now people are coming out about, you know, what's happened to them. But what about, has it impacted your work and the work of No Means No worldwide?
Well, on the awareness level and on that level of just like, we haven't, in my world, we have just scratched the surface, just the speck of the tip of the iceberg of what's actually happening out there. And so any awareness, anytime anyone gets to tell their story, and get support and have resources come pouring in to help, I think all of that impacts what we're doing. But on a general day-to-day basis, I'm pretty much in the weeds doing what I'm doing right now because we're scaling up and we're going to go into a Native American reservation for a big training and starting a field office there. So I think that some of the rates on the Native reservations are as high as I've ever seen them anywhere.
Yes.
The big difference is that the people there are super courageous and they're just like, our children are being raped and we're going to do something about it. And they're kind of rolling out the red carpet for us, which we're not used to. But it's just this determination there that it's just blowing me away. I've never seen anything quite like it. So the rates are really high. There's a lot of stuff going on there that I'm really familiar with because I grew up in that kind of environment of like lots of addiction. But I think they have the highest rate of teen suicide in the country. It's the third poorest community in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti and Pine Ridge Reservation. So there's a lot going on there because you could say, well, are rape and poverty linked? You bet they are. And so we're looking at some really, really high rates there, but we're also looking at a community that is determined to do something about it. And they just might be the first community in the world to teach every child in two schools, K through 12.
Wow.
And that's our goal. And they might be the first. And if they do that, I will bow down to them for taking away every argument anyone else might have for not doing it in their school, you know?
Right, right.
So it's really powerful what these people are putting together to help us and the plans and the teachers and the tribal elders and what everybody's doing to make this happen. It's a community effort, but it goes back to there's no plug and play. It's a comprehensive program if you want to have impact and you want to community-wide generational change, which is what we're after.
Right, right. So we have less than 4 minutes left. I have more than 10 questions left. So there's two that I really want to get to. One is, do you believe that there are conversations about rape prevention that are still not happening, or is everything out on the table at this point?
I think some of the stuff that we've been talking about here are the ones that are still not happening. It's really like turning that anger into, you know, at men and their apologies and
right,
stuff, and like
right.
really looking at that. I think that we need to look at the prevalence of awareness campaigns. After a while, they just don't really work. And we need to put money into prevention. You know, again, that deep dive, there's no easy way. And I
right.
think that that's probably one of the biggest conversations. And the other part is that something can be done about this. We're doing something about this. We don't have to be passive anymore and wonder what can be done. It's just tough. It's not the easy way. It's not the answer people want. But it doesn't mean that that we haven't gotten rates down to zero in a really vulnerable community, that we haven't gotten rates down 50% wherever we teach. Something can be done, and boys and girls are a big, big part of that. And I think we need to believe in them and give them the credit that they deserve, because their use of this is a lot more judicious than we could ever imagine. We just need to give them the skills and they do the rest. Thank you very much.
Right, right. So the last question in under 2 minutes is, I'm sure you have many challenges. I would think that one of them would be financially, how do you keep this going? So if people hear this and are inspired to help, what is the best way that they can help you? By visiting the website and donating? Is that the number one thing that you do as the call to action for our listeners?
Yeah. I guess resources right now will help us. You know, resources just basically translate into the number of trainers that we have, and the number of trainers translates into the number of kids that we can reach.
Right.
You know, it really does translate on the ground. So, you know, just for your listeners, you know, my husband and I self-funded this for almost 9 years for $2 million of our own money. We know how to pinch a penny when you have to spend your own. So we're as low cost and no cost as you can possibly get. So we're a pretty trustworthy organization that if you do support us, it is going to be direct action. It will reach that child.
Right, right.
It will reach that woman.
And there's other ways to help by educating yourselves about it and getting on board. Lee, this has been delightful. I would love to invite you back in about a year so you can talk about what's happened on the reservations. Everybody, September 20th, Sylvia Brown and Elizabeth Weintraub to talk about Girls on the Run, a prevention program. And then on the 25th, Larry Lincoln, Reclaimed Banished Voices, A Case for Compassion. Lee, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really great being here, Janani.